this is what you're fighting for. I mean, every day you're out there.
What they're doing is blowing people off.
If you continue to look the other way and shut up, then the oppressors, the authoritarians, get total control and total power. Because this is just like in Arizona, this is just like in Georgia. It's another element that backs them into a corner and shows their lies and misrepresentations.
This is why this audience is going to have to get engaged. As we've told you, this is the fight.
All this nonsense, all this spin, they can't handle the truth.
War Room, Battleground. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Capilo, stay. Not me.
This is my body, which is being given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.
Churches across the nation and indeed around the world are now moving to virtual worship services. Online services, either live streamed or recorded ahead of time or posted to YouTube or Facebook or Zoom or GoToMeeting or however churches are doing this, we're all seeming to necessarily move online. So the question is a virtual Lord's Supper going to be the next crest of the wave as it comes to this technological worship that we're doing today?
Hey everybody, in today's video we are going to talk about virtual reality and the metaverse, specifically church in the metaverse, and I'm going to take you with me visiting church in the metaverse in virtual reality for the first time. Let's get our metaverse on. Can't see a thing.
Pandemic has changed the way people attend church. Online services have become popular. But as News 4's Taylor Mitchell found out, some churches are moving past Zoom and turning to virtual reality.
To hop into the metaverse, all you need is a headset and two controllers. Let's go inside. Right now, I'm standing in front of the Life Church Metaverse, where you can connect with friends and meet people from around the world and experience church in a whole new way. Let's go in and check it out.
Welcome to Life Church. Come on in.
There's plenty right here. I'll go ahead and drop a few on the ground for those who are shorter.
Great. Thank you for your patience, everyone. Go ahead and pick up your piece of bread, and I'll go ahead and verbally talk us through it, remembering it all. As we partake of the bread, we are remembering Jesus' body that was broken for you. His body was broken and blood was shed so that we would never have to be abandoned.
Hello, it is Thursday, March 28th in the year of our Lord, 2024. I'm Joe Allen, sitting in for Stephen K. Bannon on the War Room. This will be the first of a two-part series, Communion and Crucifixion, an iconic panorama of the Passion. The subject is, of course, Jesus Christ, the Savior of the Christian tradition. The subject of our talk here, though, is not necessarily a theological one. I am not a theologian. I am not a minister. My purpose is not to proselytize nor to interpret the scripture for you. My purpose is to give you a sense of how the images of Jesus have changed from the time of Christ himself through the spread of the early church to orthodoxy into the Protestant Reformation and, of course, the postmodern period in which we find ourselves, where relentless transformation sees the images of Jesus distorted and, in my view, perverted far outside of anything that was originally intended in the gospel. To begin with, I would like to talk about the communion, the Last Supper that Jesus put together with his disciples. He brought together those closest to him. He broke bread, which he said was symbolic of his body. He passed a cup of wine, which he said was symbolic of his blood. And this communion, this supper, has marked the Christian tradition for 2,000 years. It is the way in which Christians have shown their loyalty to Jesus, their loyalty in some sense to the church, and to come together with each other in order to give some sort of symbolic or actual a confession of their participation in the crucifixion of Christ. Just to give you a sense of the different images of Jesus that we're talking about, you see here an Orthodox depiction of the Last Supper. The icon, as you can see, is somewhat vague as to the physical features. This comes from the 15th century. In the Orthodox tradition, the images of Jesus, the icons, are intended to be ways to direct the attention or the consciousness towards supernatural entities who are not readily accessible, obviously, by the senses or in any way that would be literal for the worshiper. This is a bit different in some ways from the Catholic portrayal. The Catholic portrayal, of course, has been a more realistic, more photorealistic. Of course, the statues are three-dimensional and oftentimes very, very lifelike or intended to actually capture the physicality. For Catholics, this is not to say that Catholics are idolatrous. Again, this is not a sermon, but it is to say that these are very, very different ways of approaching the divine. And in the Last Supper here, you see the iconic image from Leonardo da Vinci. You can see a sense of drama that the intent is to bring the worshiper into the world of first century Rome and Judea in the time of Jesus. We have here a much more modern portrayal. This comes from Salvador Dali. It looks as if the Last Supper is occurring not in a nondescript home as it's portrayed in the Gospels, but rather in some sort of postmodern sky rise. And there's a lot of imagination here. You see a kind of supernatural figure that kind of anticipates the crucifixion of Jesus hovering over the occasion. You can see a kind of translucence to the figures. These transformed images of Jesus will be rife throughout the modern period, as we'll soon see. The cold open, we saw people talking about coming together for communion or the Lord's Supper in virtual reality. And there are a number of different kind of fringe religious organizations that are working towards creating virtual digital icons of Jesus, digital images of Jesus, with which the worshiper can commune in a very, very literal way, in a very realistic way. And what I see in it, in all of this, is basically the traditions of the ancient past shrinking in their influence, shrinking in their impact, and being replaced in many ways either by modern secular culture or by a postmodern, highly digitized religious culture that is a sort of synthesis of the modern and postmodern view with the traditional views. Now, a number of critics of Christianity looked at Jesus as not a historical figure, but rather as a kind of reconstruction of ancient pagan myths. You can see in these images taken from, just common wiki common sources for copyright purposes, but you can see images of Dionysus on the left, of Adonis on, I'm sorry, the images of Adonis on the left, Dionysus in the center, and Osiris on the right. The scholar, the 19th century scholar James G. Frazier, described these entities as precursors, as anticipations of the story of Jesus, his crucifixion, and even the meaning of the Mass, of the Eucharist, and of the Lord's Supper. The god Adonis, from ancient Syria to the northeast of Judea, was a pagan god which was said to have been born miraculously from a tree, to have become the lover of Aphrodite, to have been killed tragically by a boar. And Adonis was associated with agriculture, with wheat. And the assumption on the part of Frazier and many subsequent postmodern philosophers was that this anticipates the Christian ritual, especially the meal. Adonis was in some way a symbol for the dying of the crops in the winter and the rebirth of the crops in the spring. And the festivals would have seen a lot of feasts. And the argument made by Frazier and many subsequent scholars is that that feast was the basically reenacted not only in the Lord's Supper of Jesus as it was celebrated by Christians, but perhaps even to some extent adopted by the Jewish tradition in the Passover in order to kind of co-opt or to gain power over the pagan societies around them. In the center there, you see Dionysus. Dionysus was a Greek god, the Greek god of the vine, of the grape, of the wine. And Dionysus was said to be the son of Zeus, a kind of half man, half god. He had many adventures. He was not a particularly benevolent god. He was very much a trickster. He was always, it was never clear whether he was helping or hindering the people around him, the human beings around him. But he still came to be celebrated as a divine being in the Greek tradition and in the later Roman tradition as Bacchus. And the Romans famously had the Bacchanalia, in which you would have somewhat orgiastic behavior centered around the wine, centered around the consumption of the sacred drink. And of course, again, you see the implication by James G. Frazier and later scholars that the wine element of the communion was in some way a co-opting of pagan traditions and simply transformed into a new Christian tradition. Osiris, also a god of agriculture from Egypt, said to have been betrayed by Seth, his brother, to have been murdered, and his body recovered by his wife slash sister Isis. And Osiris was also a god of agriculture, a god of the wheat. Again, this is to me, on a personal level, an attempt to subvert the divinity or the mysticism of the Christian rite and to simply make it one among many traditions that were, in essence, a continuation of the pagan tradition. We have here, a later iteration of the images of Jesus, mosaics that were taken from the Basilica of the Annunciation. This is located in Nazareth. I had the privilege of visiting it some years back. And you can see these differing images of Jesus put together in the modern era, donated by various nations, Ethiopia, China, Thailand, and on the far right there, America. And what you can see there is this actual transformation of Jesus into a racial archetype that is more relatable by the Christian worshiper. And so you have the African Jesus on the left, you have the Chinese and Thai Jesus in the center, and a sort of deracinated or nondescript Mary on the right. What this tells us is that to some extent, from the very beginning, The message of Jesus had to be transmitted across various languages, and the images of Jesus were oftentimes transformed in order to capture the imagination of worshipers. It's very important in terms of the communion, because what we're talking about is the importance of the body. This concept of the body is very important when we look at the Gospels, because we see Jesus and his life unfolding as a man, as a human being. And so when we go to the Last Supper and we see in the Gospel, he is eating with his disciples, he is washing their feet in an act of humility. He is very much a physical being, and he is talking to them about his body being broken as a sacrifice in order that people may be saved from the depredations of Satan, of the devil. And it's taking place during Passover. So we see Jesus as not just a human, but as a Jew, as a Jewish rabbi. And he's oftentimes called rabbi throughout the Gospels. He is basically presiding over a Passover meal as a Jew. But the Jewish tradition would be dramatically altered in subsequent Christian tradition. You would have the Passover celebrated now as the Holy Supper, as the communion, as the Lord's Supper. And instead of the various elements representing the story of Exodus, the various elements now represent a kind of exodus of the soul across the desert of this world and into the promised land of heaven. The story of the Last Supper also features Jesus's betrayal, and so we see one of the darker elements of human nature. When Judas Iscariot is given a piece of bread to indicate that he is the one that will betray Jesus to the Romans, we see in the book of John that that is the moment in which Satan entered into him. We see that human nature is in some sense resonant also with this evil, this demonic force. But what's ironic about this, what's ironic about Satan having a crucial role in the crucifixion, is that the crucifixion itself has to unfold according to Orthodox Christian theology in order for Jesus to be sacrificed, in order for the world to be saved. It's a very complex web of narratives and figures that shift from one gospel to the next. In Matthew, Mark, Luke, you see in the Synoptic Gospels, you see Jesus with his disciples talking about the bread and the wine being in remembrance of him. But in the Gospel of John, in the more mystical gospel conveyed to the beloved disciple according to its words, you have a somewhat different, or at least a more intense interpretation of what Jesus meant by the bread and the wine. We see in a passage, not during the Lord's Supper, but in an earlier sequence, you see Jesus saying that he is the bread of heaven, that the bread of heaven, his body, and the blood, the wine, that Jesus is in fact offering his body as a form of salvation in and of itself. And so that becomes very apparent in the Catholic tradition and the Orthodox tradition, and somewhat subdued in the Protestant tradition. This is also a good opportunity to look at the ways in which different societies contemporary to the early Christians saw the Christians themselves. The Romans, of course, who crucified Jesus, would condemn the subsequent Christian church for various forms of idolatry, the refusal to worship the emperor, and they accused the Christians of cannibalism. There were many recordings from Roman historians, but maybe one of the most important was, in fact, from a Christian, Marcus Minucius Felix, in his book Octavius, in which he describes a conversation between a Christian and a Roman, and the Roman is accusing the Christian of actually practicing child sacrifice, that they are sacrificing infants and eating the flesh and drinking the blood. This is not— I don't bring this up to linger on the morbidity of it, but I do bring it up to show that the images of Jesus from within the church are very, very different from those without, and that the accusations of all manner of blasphemy and depravity before the Christians took power in the Orthodox Church were used to justify the constant persecution and attempted removal of Christians from Roman society. Now, this would continue on once Christians did ascend to the orthodoxy, but from the other side. And so we see in the work of one heretic hunter, Epiphanius, the accusation that the non-orthodox Gnostic Christians, the Borborites, that they were also conducting a sort of perverse Last Supper or perverse communion in which there were sexual orgies and various bodily fluids used for the communion rite itself. Now, many Orthodox Christians would probably argue that those accusations were in fact valid, but there are good reasons to question it. You look at the Gnostic texts that have been uncovered in the 20th century, and you compare them to many of the accusers, such as Epiphanius, and what you find is a dramatic dissonance. What seems to be happening there, just as with the Christians under the Romans, is that Gnostic Christians and various other heretics were perhaps being accused of acts that they were not doing in order to justify the power of the church, the political power of the church. This cycle of power and persecution is going to continue on through the medieval period. One of the more interesting sequences that we see in the history of the church, what we see throughout this era is the constant struggle to spread Christianity by way of both proselytization, but also by way of political authority throughout Europe, throughout the Middle East, throughout North Africa, and eventually across the world. One of the more interesting segments of this history is the attempt to convert the Saxons. The Saxons were notoriously violent. They were a pagan people that held their god Wotan as being one of the highest in their pantheon, and Wotan was a god of war, a magician who had hung himself on the world tree and used this self-mortification ritual to attain the runes, the magic runes, by which political power and warfare could be enacted. So the Christians, as they moved into this area, what is now Germany on up into what's now Scandinavia, they would convert, they would leave the monks behind, the soldiers would withdraw, the pagans would kill the monks, and the cycle would begin all over again. In the 9th century, a monk put together a synthesis of the four gospels that converted the gospel into a myth that would be, or a story that would be more amenable to the Germanic people, called the Heliand. And in the Heliand, we see Jesus as a chieftain. We see Jesus being followed not by fishermen and by tax collectors, but by warriors, by thanes. And the attempt to translate the tradition into not only the language of the German people, but also into the cultural traditions of the German people is, on the one hand, obviously a distortion of the gospel. This was not the original intent of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But what you do also have is a somewhat successful conversion of the Roman people through this translation. The Last Supper takes place in a mead hall. And the myth itself, or the story itself, is intended to be recited sort of like a warrior's song in a mead hall. And this would keep moving on into the modern period, the postmodern period. You would see these various conversions of the images of Jesus to either adapt the gospel to the peoples to which the gospel was being transmitted, or you would see the peoples taking the image of Jesus and projecting their own values onto him, whether those values be economic, political, and in our present age, technological. The real crux of these conversions is that the images of Jesus are not held in any sort of definite way. The real crux, or the real question that is raised by all of this, is whether or not these transformations of Jesus leave what is important intact. Does Jesus survive as a spiritual being into these images? Or is the use of the imagery actually occluding or obscuring the true Jesus of the gospel, the true Christ of heaven, from those to whom these gospels or these perversions of the gospel were to touch? When we come back from break, we'll look at the images of Jesus as they were as they've been transformed to fit a technological society. But before we go, I would like to direct your attention to birchgold.com. Go to birchgold.com/Bannon if you want to store your wealth in something that can somehow evade the coming digital system that we are encountering.
The so-called financial experts thought we were in the clear. They were anticipating around 6 rate cuts by the Fed this year, and then the inflation data came out higher than expected. Friends, this isn't going away. It can't. The U.S. is $34 trillion plus in the hole, and yet we keep printing money, which pushes the prices you pay every day even higher. So you can either bury your head in the sand or you can do something about it. Diversify a portion of your savings into gold with Birch Gold Group. Gold is your hedge against inflation, and Birch Gold makes it easy to own. They'll help you convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and you don't pay a penny out of pocket. Text Bannon, B-A-N-N-O-N, to 989898 and get your free info kit on gold. Then talk to a precious metals specialist on how to protect your savings from persistent inflation with gold. Text Bannon, B-A-N-N-O-N, to 989898. Do it today. Action, action, action. I want to warn you of a huge change that could be coming to our money and our bank accounts. First, think back to 9/11, shortly after the government pushed through the Patriot Act. This gave the government power to spy on innocent Americans by monitoring our phone and email and tracking our movement across the internet. Now, Jim Rickards, editor of the independent financial newsletter Strategic Intelligence and New York Times bestselling author, is warning about a coming event that could elevate this governmental surveillance to a terrifying new level. In fact, some of the guests I've had on the War Room believe that the government will soon expand their powers to track our every move. If we say the wrong things on social media, donate to the wrong causes, buy firearms, or even vote MAGA, the government may be able to shut us out of our bank accounts. I can't say for sure if this will happen, but it's an interesting and dire warning. Fortunately, Jim Rickards, an American patriot and friend of mine, has made it his mission to educate us on what he believes is coming and how to protect yourself from the possibility of programmable money. Watch Jim's warning video now before it's censored like I've been in the past. Go to RickardsWarRoom.com. That's RickardsWarRoom.com now to see the video. The apples in your holiday pie taste amazing, but it's not exactly the recommended 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. The Mayo Clinic says if you want to help prevent heart disease, lower blood pressure, and your cholesterol, eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day, which, as you know, is almost impossible. That's why you need to check out Field of Greens. Every fruit and vegetable in Field of Greens was medically selected by doctors to support your vital organs, like your heart, your lungs, your kidneys, and your immune system. Yo, folks, the holidays are here and you need to stay healthy. Plus, you'll notice your skin, hair, and nails will look healthier. Field of Greens is the simplest way to get those daily fruits and veggies, and it tastes amazing. Let me get you started with 15% off your first order. Visit fieldofgreens.com. Use promo code Bannon. That's promo code Bannon at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Make sure you take it today. Use your agency. Action, action, action. Fieldofgreens.com. Promo code Bannon.
all this nonsense, all this spin. They can't handle the truth.
War Room Battleground with Stephen K. Bannon.
Churches across the nation and indeed around the world are now moving to virtual worship services. Online services, either live streamed or recorded ahead of time or posted to YouTube or Facebook or Zoom or GoToMeeting or however churches are doing this, we're all seeming to necessarily move online. So the question is a virtual Lord's Supper going to be the next crest of the wave as it comes to this technological worship that we're doing today?
Hey everybody, in today's video we are going to talk about virtual reality and the metaverse, specifically church in the metaverse, and I'm going to take you with me visiting church in the metaverse in virtual reality for the first time. Let's get our metaverse on. Can't see a thing.
Pandemic has changed the way people attend church. Online services have become popular. But as News 4's Taylor Mitchell found out, some churches are moving past Zoom and turning to virtual reality.
To hop into the metaverse, all you need is a headset and two controllers. Let's go inside. Right now, I'm standing in front of the Life Church Metaverse, where you can connect with friends and meet people from around the world and experience church in a whole new way. Let's go in and check it out.
Welcome to Life Church. Come on in.
There's plenty right here. I'll go ahead and drop a few on the ground for those who are shorter.
Great. Thank you for your patience, everyone. Go ahead and pick up your piece of bread, and I'll go ahead and verbally talk us through it, remembering it all. As we partake of the bread, we are remembering Jesus' body that was broken for you. His body was broken and blood was shed so that we would never have to be abandoned.
And welcome back. The video we just saw is indicative of the tremendous transformation that we're undergoing right now in the modern world. We see the rise of technological systems in which technology itself is held up as a deity. But also, simultaneously with this, we see traditional religion being digitized, being converted into a modern form. The questions that are raised by the transformation of the Passover meal into the Eucharist, or the transformation of the Gospels into Germanic poems to be sung by warriors in mead halls, are critical to the direction that modern society takes, that spiritual life takes moving into the future. The question is, does Jesus survive in the new images that we see? Or is it occluded so dramatically that any follower going down that path is in fact becoming more distant from the spiritual, more distant from the original intent of the gospel than they would have had they not encountered it at all? I'd like to move to an image, if the team could throw it up. This was painted by the psychedelic artist Alex Gray. It's called The Cosmic Christ, and you can see perhaps in some of the details, satellites, computers, various indications that this is a Christ for the modern world. The Orthodox would condemn it entirely. Even Protestants would balk at this sort of perversion of the original images of Jesus. But for modern people and in a culture of total acceptance and tolerance, this is just one of many ways that one might approach the divine. The name Cosmic Christ comes from the paleontologist and Jesuit priest Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin, in his book, The Phenomenology of Man, talks about humanity hurtling towards an omega point. His theory was that life on Earth is evolving towards the total unification of humanity and a joining of the human spirit with the cosmic spirit that pervades the entire universe. De Chardin believed that this was occurring by way of technology. He talked about a noosphere, a sphere that hangs over top of the biological sphere, which is overlaid by the sphere of human endeavor and the human psyche. And this noosphere is a means by which the entire planet is being wired to become one single unity. He saw the ultimate unity of humanity converging on what he called an omega point, the end of history, the point at which human souls would be unified with the cosmic Christ to which we're all being drawn. War Room listeners will, of course, see the similarities between this and the current technologists' concept of the singularity. The singularity, of course, is that convergence of all of these different technological sectors, from artificial intelligence to the brain-computer interface to genetic engineering, converging onto a new humanity, a humanity that is not really distinguishable from the machine, and a world in which the machine is not really distinguishable from the organisms, the biology. So what you see in the singularity, as we've talked about many, many times, is a kind of modernization, or in many ways kind of a postmodern view of the original Christian ideal that human beings would eventually meet God, meet Christ in the world beyond. The author Ray Kurzweil called his landmark book in 2005, The Singularity Is Near. The title is, in fact, a play on Jesus's promise that the kingdom of heaven is near. But in this case, it is not a supernatural connection to Christ, which will save humanity. What will happen, according to Kurzweil and his predecessors and his successors, is that human beings will be saved from our own evolved nature by artificial intelligence and engineering our genome into some sort of transmuted or perfected form. Alongside of this technological revolution, you see transformations of the images of Jesus flooding the public sphere. So you see here an artificial intelligence generated image in which the prompt engineer simply asked, give me an image of Jesus taking a selfie with his disciples. One could imagine perhaps this is at the Last Supper. And it raises that question again. Is Jesus in this image? Do we see the Jesus of the gospel? Do we see the Jesus who sat with his disciples around a table, offering bread and wine as remembrance for his body and blood? Or do we see a self-absorbed narcissist staring into a camera with all his pals around? I would argue that it is the latter. And as people are playing with these images of Jesus, the true messages of the gospel, the messages of kindness, the messages of charity, the messages of self-sacrifice are eroded and replaced by a more modern materialistic form. This comes from last year. Fox News did a report on a new AI app that allows users to talk to Jesus directly. It's a large language model that was trained on Jesus's words from the gospel. And you can ask Jesus anything and he responds in text form as if you were actually talking to Jesus himself. There are a lot of departures, as we saw with many of the other images of Jesus previous, a lot of departures from the original messages of Jesus, so that if you, for instance, ask Jesus what his opinion on homosexual marriage is, this app, Texting with Jesus, will respond that the gospel encourages charity, and so all people are to be welcomed and included. You see here also a much more intense form of all of this. This is from a text thread by an ex-user called Sun. It made a lot of rounds. It caused a lot of outrage. And you can see these images of Jesus are AI generated. The one on the left is particularly obvious. You can see the multiple fingers. He has like 6-7 fingers, very common of AI generated images. But what's most important about this isn't necessarily the kind of translation of the images of Jesus by way of AI, but what this gentleman or perhaps woman says. So I quote, "My brothers and sisters in Christ, Who wants to join me in forking the Judeo-Christian base to form a new secular religion that reinterprets the second coming of Christ as the advent of artificial superintelligence, the singularity? You see there, he says Christ plus AI equals Christ, I suppose. And he goes on, a secular religion that would merge transhumanism with the Abrahamic mimetic framework. It would be more palatable to the Western religious base, raise tax-free funds for study, media, preparation for ASI or artificial superintelligence, and create a strong futurist community that's sorely lacking in our divided time. It might also be a good hedge in the Paschal wager in case AI becomes independent as it might preserve or be friendly to those most caring of the new creation, our descendant of our kin, but not our kind. This is one of many, many examples of kind of fringe thinkers forming these subcultures or subcults around AI itself as a coming deity. And so when he talks about the Paschal's wager that is being made here, it's a reference to the original concept that if God exists and you are saved, the original Paschal's wager was an argument that it is safer to bet on salvation than atheism. If God exists and you are saved, then you go to heaven. If God exists and you are not saved, you go to hell. Whereas if God doesn't exist, it doesn't hurt to be saved. The original Paschal's wager was an argument to be saved, not necessarily because God exists, but because if God does exist, the gravity of that decision is ultimate. If God doesn't exist and you get saved, it doesn't matter. You don't get saved, it doesn't matter. If God does exist, then to be saved is the critical decision. To not be saved means eternity in hell. The images you see before you in the religious tradition, if you want to call it that, that are emerging, oftentimes speak of Rocco's Basilisk. And it's basically a technological transformation of the concept of Paschal's wager. If AI never comes to being in a godlike form, then it won't matter if you pledged your fealty or pledged your loyalty or encouraged its development. You simply go along as if it had never happened. However, if AI becomes super intelligent, then you would basically be beholden to this deity in the same sense as Christians conceive of the Judeo-Christian God. And if artificial intelligence sees you as a threat, or if artificial intelligence rakes over your social media posts, such as mine, and sees that you did not want it to be developed, then it could resurrect your data and torture you for all eternity. Whereas if you support it, you have the hope that you can live in some sort of digital heaven forever. And so therefore, the Rocco's Basilisk, or this technological Paschal wager, holds in a sort of theological sense that your best bet as a human being is to pledge fealty to the digital God while you still can. This transformation is not isolated to these cults. These are extreme forms of what are ultimately becoming kind of mundane observations about the nature of progress. So that instead of Jesus's miracles of feeding the 4,000 with bread, or Jesus's miracle of transforming the water into wine at the wedding of Cana, you have the promise that technology will be able to produce radical abundance, to produce bread and wine forever for beings who are basically digital immortals. And this idea might seem ridiculous, but we hear folks like Elon Musk talking about radical abundance. We hear Google R&D director Ray Kurzweil talking about digital immortality. And this transformation is one of the spiritual into the material rather than the other way around. And it raises again the question, does Jesus survive in these images, or is Jesus's image so transformed as to become something else, perhaps something satanic? I would argue at the very least that what we are seeing is a complete overhaul of what tradition holds, that human beings were created in the divine image, that our ultimate goals are to be kind to one another, to take care of one another, to defend our traditions, and ultimately to transcend the body into a spiritual state. The technological tradition, if you want to call it a tradition, information, the technological religion that we see forming around us holds that all of these goals can be achieved by way of human endeavor, by way of technologists, by way of human invention. It is a total inversion. And so the images of Jesus, while they do in some sense reflect the ancient, becomes something completely new, and in my view, something darker than the blackest night. If I may, I'd like to return to one important theme from the Last Supper. We see in the Last Supper in the Gospel, Jesus washing the disciples' feet and instructing them to wash each other's feet. And this act of humility is, on the one hand, very human. On the other hand, it transcends the selfish nature of humanity and shows us in a symbolic and actual visceral form the command to sacrifice oneself for other people. I would like to conclude with a story about a foot washing ritual that I myself attended. When I was at Boston University, I studied religion through the lens of science, but my master's thesis, while invoking a lot of scientific concepts, focused on the religious tradition that was began by a man named Jean Vanier. And Jean Vanier began an organization called L'Arche, French for the Ark. The purpose of L'Arche is to allow people with intellectual disabilities, people with Down syndrome, people with severe autism, people whose genetic or in vitro damage had left them unable to fend for themselves. And so this ark, L'Arche, is a vessel by which helpless beings could be conveyed across this world. I attended, just before Easter, a foot washing ceremony in a Catholic church north of Boston. And you had dozens of people gathered there, most of whom suffered severe disabilities, be it mental or a few physical deformities. And as the bowl was passed around, I realized that the woman next to me was completely deformed by a congenital birth defect. She had feet that looked like clubs and small digits protruding. And my natural response, which I should be hopefully forgiven for, was one of revulsion, one of disgust. But as the bowl came around to me and it came my turn to wash her feet, something strange happened. All revulsion left me, and I looked into her eyes, and I saw their kindness. I saw their real understanding and a fierce intelligence. It was simply her body, not her mind, that had been compromised. And there was something in the beauty of that moment that it has never left me, this feeling that our flawed human lives, I was left with the sense that we are, as human beings, completely vulnerable. And I saw in this woman very much a reflection of myself as a flawed human being in need of salvation. In the technological era, in the technocratic era, in an era of efficiency, salvation is a matter of erasing people like her and creating a perfected humanity. In the traditions of Christianity and other traditions around the world, there is a call to see flawed human beings as souls shrouded in bodies. And so the foot washing ritual given by Jesus lingers on as a reminder that we owe each other our energy, our kindness, our efforts. And we are here to protect one another under the divine. I know I promised that I would not preach, but maybe that was a slight departure. Maybe I fibbed a little bit, but, you know, hopefully forgiveness can be had. As we move into the Easter, I wish you all a happy holiday. I hope you're able to spend this time with loved ones over meals. And I hope that as we move forward as a nation, that we can find some semblance of the tradition that brought us here. Thank you very much, and I'll see you tomorrow night.
Right now, millions of Americans face prescription medication shortages. The FDA's medication shortage list currently has over 120 prescription medications listed. Some patients are being forced into more expensive substitutes, while others are rationing what little medication they have left. Don't get caught unprepared. That's why I want you to pick up a Jace case today. The Jace case is a pack of essential antibiotics that can treat a long list of common bacterial illnesses, including UTIs, respiratory and skin infections, plus much more. And each case can be customized for your specific needs with dozens of add-on options. Just fill out a simple online form and Jace handles the rest, from the online evaluation to licensed pharmacy delivery and ongoing care. Visit jacemedical.com and use code Bannon at checkout for an extra discount. That's promo code Bannon at Jace, J-A-S-E, jacemedical.com. Get the Jace case and get it today. Action, action, action. That's code War Room at checkout to save 67%. Do it again. War Room Health, all one word, warroomhealth.com. Go there today. You need, if you're going to be part of the posse, you need a strong heart. You need a lion's heart. How we're going to do that is with Salty. Go there, do it today, check it out.